First things first. So what's, you know, how are those particles going? I know you had a request. I saw it.
Yeah, I
want to
see, you know, so you said the IDS, right?
The,
I think there's something called IDS, right?
I don't know how it works. Oh. I've never used it. It's ID3DX. It's a part of D3DX. And the only dealing that I ever had with it is one time when I had to completely eliminate it from the Xbox 360 libraries because it wasn't working and nobody knew after years. So that will tell you how many Xbox 360 developers have been using it.
Because it seems perfect for using the particles. For what little I saw.
Perfect?
Well, not
maybe.
Perfect, but
maybe not. I don't know.
The interface, it looked like it was only good for drawing sprites that were right on front of the screen, not for runs in the distance. So,
yeah, honestly, I don't know. I would expect that it's either something to draw quads on the screen. Sometimes they call them sprites, like, you know, basically drawing 2D, right? Or, so it's possible it was just that. And it's possible it's actually for sprites in 3D. The thing is, if it's sprites in 3D, I would hope that one of those ID3DX sprite objects will allow you to specify all the sprites in, like, one particle system or something. Because you don't want to do things one tiny little sprite at a time. Ever. Part of the allure of the sprites, doing particles, you know, with sprites, is that you can do a ton of them, right? And a ton of them means, depending on your machine, 20, hundreds, or thousands, or millions.
Well, there was also something
at a time.
Point sprite, which may be.
Point sprite is a mode of rendering in D3D. Oh. So, you know that you can render triangles, right?
Right.
You can render lines,
right?
You can also render point sprites. The problem is point sprites have never been properly specified, so different GPUs will treat them differently. If you attempt to use them, then it may work in your machine, but maybe not in others. They're kind of hard to use reliably. They were used by games like Quake 2, I believe, used them. Because they were exposed also in OpenGL, and Quake 2 was OpenGL,
right,
mostly. So basically used them for like blood spurts and things like that.
Right.
One limitation of point sprites is that they're limited in size. They cannot get too big.
Right.
You know, the GPU will limit that somehow. Or not, because different GPUs work differently and nobody cares.
Right. So I guess my question is in DirectX, what's the best way to render the sprites that you're talking about?
You generate four vertices,
right,
put them, you know, in, put them either as a tri-strip,
okay,
or, you know, just put them together with an index buffer.
Right.
You know, that'll give you quads.
Okay.
And basically, you generate those four vertices the way I was explaining at the end of last week. You know, you have a point.
I remember you said you have a point that's somewhere.
You have a point. You have the coordinates of these points, okay? And this is X, Y, Z. It's in space.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have a size. Also, you know, this point is specified, say, in world coordinates. Well, you have a size also specified in world coordinates. And this size will say, basically, the radius of your sprite.
Right.
So your sprite is going to be twice as wide as that size. Right? So this is the size. Right?
Right.
With this, you can construct a piece of geometry on the fly.
Mm.
Meaning, you construct four vertices.
Right.
Okay. Where this one will have coordinates, you know, if this is P, point P, X, Y, Z,
right,
so this is going to have coordinates P plus view vector along the X times size plus view along, sorry, this would be minus, well, actually going up, yeah, in world space, typically y is going up, so say view x and view y times size. Right? So, and this vx is just the unit vector in this direction. That direction is the x direction in view space.
Right. Hmm. So,
but you have to express it in the same frame of reference, of course, that the point is in, which right. would be usually world space.
Okay, so you're saying make this quad in world space, but kind of rotate it so that it's facing the camera.
Yeah.
Either
exactly.
straight across flip space or
exactly.
slightly angled.
Again, when we say properly rotated so it faces the camera, it doesn't mean build a rotation matrix and apply it. You know, usually just do this sort of calculation directly, right? Which gives you that result. So if you have your view matrix, okay, your view matrix, like any other general transformation, is going to have these last column of 0, 0, 0, 1, right? And then it's going to have two parts, you know, the rotation and maybe scaling and share and that sort of thing matrix, and then the translation vector in the last row, right? So this Vx would be the first column right here. That would make a vector, you know, like x, y, z coordinates. Okay, that would be... That turns out to be the unit vector along the x-axis of view space, but expressed in world coordinates. Okay, so you just use that. And the y, right? Yes?
Question about performance, although I didn't really do a detailed test of this. What I ended up doing is having a vertex buffer with four vertices.
Yes.
Just leave them the same. And I loop through the particles and I reset the transformation matrix every time and call render. Is it okay to do that, or should I set
it is okay to do that. It's not the fastest way. It is not the fastest way.
I should do some of the matrix.
The problem is every call to draw something is generally expensive. So if you do that once per particle, then you can't have hundreds of thousands of them on screen. Not can do.
Better to have a big vertex buffer.
It's better to have a big vertex buffer and fill it once, and then, you know, with some fast loop, where, you know, you just go through all the particles and say every particle generate four vertices. Or six, you know, if you don't want to have an index buffer, you know, four of them are going to be repeated two and two. Right? Typically for dynamic geometry, the fastest way is to have a, you know, if like every frame you're going to render pretty much the same thing, okay, what you have is one vertex buffer for it. And then when you write to it, you need to lock, right, to get a pointer, and then you write to it, and then you unlock. When you call lock, you can specify flags that say different things about how to lock it. Okay, those flags, some of them are basically hints to the D3D runtime and to the graphics driver about what you are going to do with the pointer once you get it. Basically, they're hints about your intentions. Okay, and that's a very powerful tool for the runtime and for the driver, because they can do optimizations based on that. For instance, there's a flag that says discard, meaning I do not want to keep any of the data that I may have written previously into the vertex buffer. That's discard. So, for instance, one thing they can do is say, okay, forget about the piece of video memory that was being referenced by these vertex buffering, you know, maybe the driver will just allocate a different piece of memory. Okay? because you said discard, so it doesn't have to be the same piece of memory. That allows it to not have to wait until the GPU is done reading from the data. Because usually it would have to, right? I mean, the GPU is going to run behind, maybe a frame or two. Okay? So if you're going to overwrite some of the data, the driver is going to have to block you until that data that you're going to overwrite is not in use anymore, right? So that's one possible optimization, discard, right? Another one is no overwrite. That's a flag that says, you're going to give me a pointer, and that's perfectly fine, and I promise. And that's a promise that you make. You know, if you break it, then bad things can happen. And by bad things, I mean anything. You know, your computer crashing, blue screening, whatever. Well, not that, because especially not in, like, Windows 7. No. I'm not going to overwrite anything that I previously written to it. That's used a lot for, like, incremental things. Like, you know, you have this buffer, and then you say, I need a buffer, right? And underneath, when you call drop primitive up, you know, where you just give it a pointer, there's no vertex buffer. Underneath, there is a vertex buffer, kind of. And it uses something like this. It basically copies your data into that buffer. And that buffer is typically like a big buffer that's used in a circular fashion, right? So, you know, you want to write a K of data in a vertex buffer. Okay, fine. You know, it just says I'm going to overwrite and, you know, writes the K of data and then stores how far it went, writing into the buffer, right? And the rest left untouched. The next time you want, you know, some more data, you'll lock it again and say, I'm going to continue filling it, right? And never overwriting previous data. That allows it to also not wait. It's like, yeah, it's the same buffer, but you're saying, hey, you know, I'm just not going to overwrite anything that I have previously written to it and that the GPU might be using.
So you could kind of do a 20,000 circular queue and just add.
Yeah. So you keep adding to it. When you run out of space, then you discard, right, and start from scratch, right? So the driver will just allocate a different buffer. And once the previous buffer is finished being used, you know, the driver will recycle it somehow. So, and that's what, you know, the type of thing that people typically do when when generating dynamic geometry like particles. Again, I'm not asking you to do this, right? It is the professional way. Yeah, I mean, it works, and our games are small and they're not taxing the GPUs too much, right? So it's okay. You know, it's not. But this type of methodology of using these flags to tell the driver, you know, don't do anything slow, basically. you know, because I know how to do things, right? You know, you're promising the driver, right? So this type of methodology is what allows you to have, you know, a particle system with 10,000 particles in it. You know, which looks a lot better than one with 20. Okay. But of course, you know, particle systems with 20 particles actually, you know, well done can be kind of very useful. You know, it's not.
It's not the end of the world. Sparks or something. Can you just use points instead of quads or triangles?
For sparks?
Yeah, something small.
Yeah, I mean, points can be used. Personally, I've tried to use them a few times. I've always gotten into gotchas and, you know, I never fully learned how to use them. So I'm not going to attempt to teach you how to use them. You know, the point sprites that are available in some GPUs.
I wasn't thinking, is there a primitive called points rather than a triangle or something?
Yeah, there's a point list. Right. You know, there's triangle list, triangle strip, line list, line strip. there is a point list.
Right.
That point list is for points, for point sprites.
Right. Mm.
So that means every little thing that gets rendered, just one vertex. And the vertex specifies what's in here. Okay. The texture coordinates, you know, if you're applying a texture to it, are generated. For instance. So it basically assumes that you're just gonna plaster one entire texture in, you know, whatever sprite ends up.
I was thinking more along the lines of, you know, like for the line of sight debug line, we're drawing a line. Why not just draw a point and not apply any texture to it, just a color RGBA or something?
Yeah, again, it can be tricky to get that particular part of the GPU working correctly in all computers. That's all I'm saying. Well, that's not all I'm saying. The other thing I'm saying is I'm not going to attempt to try and teach you how to use it because I do not know how to use it safely and reliably. I never managed to learn that. The few times I tried. As a game developer, I just wouldn't even try anymore.
Right. So with point particles, you just have a small size, you just do it as a point. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, do these calculations in the CPU, generate the four vertices, pass them on. Questions. I should mention that this thing I talked about, you know, the using the no overwrite and discard, you know, basically those sorts of things. Actually, also sometimes useful for doing other things than particles, like text. When you're rendering text, you have several different ways. There's ID3DX font, and that basically allows you to get a font from Windows, and it somehow processes it into textures, so that you can use it in games. That one, I believe, is more usable. I don't really know all the details on how to use it, personally, but I consider it a more useful kind of thing than ID3X Sprite. The thing with text is that usually you end up having a texture like this, right? You know, this is a texture. And you end up having multiple characters in that texture, right? You know, you have the A, and the B, and the C, D, E, F, and so on and so forth. You know, you have the open parenthesis, close parenthesis, comma, right? Or everything, right? And then you just render quads, right? And in this quad, you map the portion of the texture where the character is, right? So that's usually not much of a problem. Yeah, I mean, how many letters are there in the alphabet? Not that many. But as some of you may know, the Chinese people don't use this alphabet, right? This is a different thing. And the Japanese and the Korean and, you know, for some reason, it's especially in East Asia, you know, that they have very big alphabets. You know, there is also, I mean, Arabic and Farsi and all sorts of languages all over the world.
Don't forget Klingon.
Of course not. How could I possibly? Klingon and Sindarin. Anyway, but the thing is, especially with Chinese is the biggest one that I've ever found, you know, when I'm to add text support to a game. You know, with Chinese, you could have 20,000 different characters. I mean, it's insane. So how do you do this? I mean, how do you put 20,000 characters in a texture? And the answer is you don't ever do that, right? Just, you would blow up all your video memory just having those textures, right? So there are two ways in which people deal with this issue. One of them is saying, hey, we're going to have a limited alphabet, right? So you choose a couple hundred of the glyphs and you tell your translators, you cannot use those ones, right? of course, if you don't know Chinese, you wouldn't actually choose them. But, you know, you tell your translators, you know, the entirety of your text has to be done with this many glyphs, right? And then they choose which ones. And then there are other ways. And one of them is to actually do dynamic management of a texture of glyphs, right? So when you encounter a text string that has a glyph and your texture doesn't have it, then you lock the texture and you copy it from whatever file is on this, right? And you put it in the texture, right? And then you have, you know, a texture that maybe gives you 200 of them at a time. And you say, then you tell your translators, hey, you know, we cannot have more than 200 at a time on the screen. Mm-hmm. And they have to work around that. But if you have two different screens of text, then they can have different characters, right? And you would use those flags for updating a texture like this also with no override and discard and things like that. Yes. You probably would.
So I'm just looking up why you said we shouldn't use D3DX. You said it's utilities generally not used in high performance games.
Correct.
But so it's kind of it's not in the driver or in the GPU. It's kind of libraries on top of.
Yeah, it's code that you could write yourself. Everything in D3DX is just straight out code. There is no driver specific support for it. There's nothing really fancy about it, except for the amount of work and expertise that has gone into building those functions.
So what's the problem with it? It's not used?
The problem with it is that it is, in many ways, it's like a piece of middleware. You know about middleware? Middleware is an interesting proposition when you're starting a game, right? You say, hey, you know, am I going to build everything from scratch, or am I going to get Unreal Engine, pay a bunch of dollars for it, and save all the work to create all the infrastructure to build a game? And many developers choose Unreal Engine or CryEngine or one of those. And that's perfectly fine. There's nothing wrong with that. Except that once you lock yourself to one of those, you better work within its limitations. Because every time that you get framework, a level of abstraction that allows you to work closer to, you know, the creative part of things instead of the plumbing, right? Every time, you know, you basically are locked to what was in the mind of the people who built that. What they thought was good to allow you to do. One thing that is, you know, for people who make middleware or any other sort of programming libraries, one of the big nightmares is the surface of, you know, the libraries that they are providing to you. The surface area. So how many functions, how many parameters, how many different combinations of things, and making sure that a piece of software works in every single possible combination and every possible situation and every possible type of computer with any possible GPU and graphics drivers and all that stuff, you know, it's very, very hard. So everybody has to limit the scope of what their software allows you to do when you incorporate it.
And in general, CPUs are general purpose, not specific, such as the GPU, which is specific to graphics.
Mm-hmm.
You have the trade-off between the specialization and the general purpose of something.
I don't understand
the analogy. Because like the Real Engine trying to do everything,
mm-hmm.
but it has so many functions and so many parameters, yeah. you'd be losing something versus where you know that that's to limit the surface area and get.
Yeah, I mean, the surface area problem is a problem that companies that make software that gets incorporated into other software typically encounter. I mean, I don't know if there is actually now if it's considered a discipline or something like that in computer science programs in college or not. I mean, I don't know. I don't really know the state of the art there. But it's a problem that everybody encounters one way or another when they're building software that is going to be incorporated in other software, right? And that includes everything from, the Win32 API. This design is clearly not, was not accounting for this sort of thing. It's just grown and grown and grown, and the amount of gotchas that it has is tremendous.
I think in database design, there is somewhat of a move towards middleware and having mm-hmm. either an entity model or an object model, so that mm-hmm. SQL is closer to the SQL database.
Mm-hmm.
And apps that deal with the data deal with the object model.
Yeah, and there's also the move to NoSQL and stuff like that, which I've only recently gotten aware of. And the NoSQL movement of databases. It's basically turning things upside down from the way databases work. When you have a relational database, we probably shouldn't be talking about this, right?
Maybe.
So, anyway.
Another question related to the homework form.
Good.
So, my sprites are, squares. And in order to make them look like particles, I plastered on a texture with some alpha, around the edge so that it looks like a particle.
Yeah, it looks more rounded or more amorphous, yes. Kind of like the jewels in the Bejeweled game.
But if I make my particles big, then I can see that when the particles are in front of each other, I somehow see through to the background. It's like I don't see the other particles. They somehow
see
each other.
I believe I actually mentioned this at one point or another during class, and it's come up because I actually showed you let me just show you. So this is the hardware renderer, right? It's nice and easy little program, right? So, we have a cube and the spinning teapot and the teapot with the texture and then the transparent teapot. And look what happens to the teapot. I can see the background mountains through the teapot. Can you see that?
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe even like this, you can see better. I don't know. But basically you can see the outline of the mountain here. And that mountain is what's behind this billboard. So somehow this teapot is punching a hole through the billboard. How does it do that?
Your draw.
Not only the draw order. Not just the draw order. The draw order is partially responsible for this. And yes, when you see one particle kind of punching a hole through a different particle, then it's also related to the draw order. What happens is that the draw order is incorrect. I mean, particles and the teapot, they're all transparent pieces of geometry. I mean, that's the commonality. That's what, that's what's the same in all cases. They are transparent pieces of geometry. So imagine that this is the view frustum, right? I'm looking up this way. Imagine that I have one particle and another particle. in which order do I want to draw these particles? This one first. That's the order I want, right? Because this particle is transparent, right? And it's being drawn. When it's being drawn second, it means that this one is already on screen. So when this particle does the alpha blending, this particle is already there, right? So if I see like one particle over here, another one over here, and this one is in front, right, then it's actually transparent on top of the previous one, right? So if I keep the draw order perfectly, then everything will look always perfect. In this case, I am drawing the teapot first and the billboard next. In fact, I'm drawing clearly first the ground, then the teapot, and then the billboard.
By draw order, is this influenced by is this influenced by my calls to render, or
yes, your calls to render get executed by the GPU in the same order that you give them.
Oh,
always.
It doesn't buffer everything and then sort it.
No. No, it never does that. It doesn't know what the depth of different things are until it runs the vertex shader, right? Which is the one that tells it the position of the vertices, the final position of the vertices, right? So until it runs the vertex shader, there's no way for D3D or the GPU to know what the correct order is. There are ways for you to know, but not for them, right? The GPU only gets to know this thing after a vertex buffer is executed. But of course, it doesn't actually execute all the vertex buffers for, sorry, vertex shaders. Okay, so it doesn't execute all the vertex shaders for all the geometry in your frame first. Okay, because then you have to store all the results in memory. Okay, it does everything on the fly. You know, it runs vertex shaders, and once it has a few, you know, it builds the triangles that use them and rasterizes them, generates pixels, and then those pixels get rendered. Okay. And only when it does, you know, the rasterizer is done with a vertex and says, oh, I don't need this vertex anymore, it'll replace it with a new vertex and so on. And only then will it run the actual vertex shader for it. Kind of. I mean, that's kind of the way things work.
And if you're in a case where you have a if you could fix this by drawing the background, then the billboard, then the teapot. But let's say in the case with 1 and 2, you had some opaque object kind of in between and overlapping. You know, which do you draw first where? You can't come to
So the best ordering for performance and correctness is to first render all the opaque stuff. Now, the opaque stuff is special in that it doesn't participate in alpha blending. You know, it also only makes part of the background for alpha blending for other things. If it's, you know, whichever pixels are visible, right? So all the opaque stuff can be rendered in any order. It's the transparent stuff that requires some sort of ordering, okay? And I should let you know that I think I mentioned it also in class at one point. You know, there's an algorithm called the Painter's algorithm. Painter's algorithm says render every triangle in order of depth. In which case, you don't need a Z buffer. Older hardware, the really, really old kind, did not have a Z buffer. So all triangles had to be sorted. So even in that case, you know, there is like a opaque stuff here, opaque stuff here, has to be rendered first this and then that. So that when this gets rendered, it overwrites those pixels. Otherwise, you know, whatever is in the background would overwrite the pixels of the foreground. And that's bad, right? But the thing is, the Painter's algorithm is generally non-solvable. Okay? You could have, you know, the pathological situation of three triangles. One like this, okay? One like this, which is behind, right? And then it's actually possible to have one kind of like this. Yeah, I got it right. Okay. This can happen because this is 3D, right? So this situation can happen with three dimension, you know, triangles in three dimensions. So there is no way to sort these three triangles such that you don't need a C buffer. There's no way. Okay.
You can test one thing until it resolves itself to that and also
yeah. The only way is to split this into two, one triangle here, and then this would be a quad. And then you're in there first this quad, then this, and then this last tip. But of course, you need to know, in order to do this, you need to know where to split it first, right? I mean, there are plenty of combinations of triangles that have no correct ordering between themselves. And from different points of view, the correct orderings are different. So it would have to be completely done at runtime. It's a nightmare, okay? It is a nightmare.
Yeah, so in this case...
So, and that's why the Z buffer is so awesome, because it says, hey, you know, you don't care about that. But for the transparent stuff, you do care. You do care. The thing is, because it's transparent, you know, when we're talking about particles, we don't really need the perfect sorting of the particles. We just need it sorted with the rest of the universe, right? In order for two particles not to interfere with each other, what you need, you know, if you don't want to sort them, what you need to do is make sure that you render them without updating the Z buffer. And that's the other thing that's causing this. This transparent teapot is actually writing to the Z buffer. It's saying, hey, at this pixel, the depth is over here. And then afterwards, when the billboard gets rendered behind, those pixels get rejected because it looks at the Z buffer and it says, oh, but this pixel, you know, there's already something closer rendered. So I'm not going to render.
Why isn't the background showing up at all?
Because the background is the first thing rendered. So what happens is the background gets rendered, then the teapot, and then the billboard. So we can just run the experiment just because. Just gonna do it live really quickly. Hopefully it'll work fine.
Are you saying you...
with no issues?
What?
Oh. What it's telling me is that I already have it open.
Well, I have my personal system rendering last, and it isn't interfering with any of the other objects, so I guess that's why.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so in here, you know, when it's rendering all these things, it's saying alpha blend enable is true. And I also need to say so let's see. See red enable. Okay. And false. I'm just going to restore it afterwards because just to make things simple here. So when I do that, let's see what we get. Run. So everything looks the same, except that the transparent teapot. Wait. That didn't do anything. Well, yeah, we're still seeing the background, but what we shouldn't be seeing now is the teapot. Oh. problem is here. I'm just gonna disable this here. State management. Gotta hate it. Okay, gotta hate it. Oh well, now everything is behind because I did it kind of wholesale. Not just for the transparent teapot. But you can see the transparent teapot is transparent. You can see the background through it. Oh, like you can see this hill thread. But now it's not writing the Z-buffer, so the billboard is rendered completely. Of course, the billboard is opaque, so still doesn't work. You know, the ordering is the thing that matters there. Okay. But what happened?
Doesn't seem to be in the same place anymore.
Oh, it is in the same place. I mean, the parallax of the teapot with the billboard, you know, if I move sideways, you know, the teapot is moving faster than the billboard because it's in front. But it appears to be behind, you know, it's like one of those, Escher effects, you know, only just a cheapo version of it, but it's a paradox. Yes. Okay. So with your particles, if you disable the writing to the Z buffer, what you will get is that you will not see those particles kind of punching holes, especially the corners of the particles punching holes. Okay. In each other. Okay.
But you still want to do the particles.
Which will look better.
You want to do the particles last, otherwise you get this problem.
Yeah. You want to do the particles after you've rendered the main part of your scene, of course. I mean, thinking about the order of events here, the order of rendering, when it comes to transparency, always. Okay?
Because all the opaque objects will write to the definition.
Yeah. Yeah, the transparent objects, I mean, they have multiple depths, that's the problem. So, if you write the transparent one, then you get one effect. If you leave the opaque one only, then typically things work better. Okay. When you have particles that are, say, additive transparency, okay, not only do you not want to write to the Z buffer because there could be holes through them, right? You know, but also because in any case, you know, the rendering order is completely commutative. It doesn't matter whether you render one first and the other one next. Okay. The nature of additive transparency is that it doesn't matter the order between them at all. When you're doing alpha blending, the order does matter. So, you know, you have to be, you know, more careful there with sorting the particles, or just assume that you're going to get a little glitching because the order is going to be incorrect sometimes. Yeah. More questions? Nothing? Okay. Hello? Oh. Yeah. Telling me. Okay. So, topic for today, the main topic is going to be skinning. How to do hierarchical animation of meshes, skeletal animation of meshes, where you have one single mesh, different parts move different ways, like yourself. But I want to start it with scene graphs, because some of the topics from scene graphs kind of roll over very, very nicely to the skinning. Although there are very, very different things. So, there. Okay. So, what are scene graphs? Who here has ever heard about, you know, the term scene graphs? You have, yes, maybe over there, maybe a little bit. You have. So, scene graphs is just one way to organize your game. Or at least the graphics part of your game. It's also like middleware. In that you're kind of buying into it. So when you start using a scene graph for rendering, you have to do things the scene graph way. Even when you really don't want to, you know, you tend to have to. Scene graph is, in many ways, just a data structure. It's basically putting your entire scene in a data structure. The opposite of this is to have a function, like the render function that you have there, in your game, and have it call to render a teapot, call to render a billboard, call to render a piece of ground. Okay? Explicitly there. As programmers, generally dealing with code is a little easier than dealing with data. Because code is the thing that says, this is what I'm doing, this is what I'm doing, this is what I'm doing. Okay. It's easier to keep in your mind. When you deal with data, you have other considerations like ownership of that data, lifetime of the data. If you don't do those sorts of things right, and those are concepts that have nothing to do with graphics, then you get issues like dangling pointers, dangling references, memory leaks, or leaks of other things. I mean, even Windows today leaks stuff. On occasion, some program will leave a tooltip on my screen. For some reason, it will not disappear until you reboot. Okay? Whatever program showed the tooltip on the screen is not there anymore, but somehow Windows keeps it around. And that happens especially now in Windows 7 and with Windows Vista. It did not happen with Windows XP. Why? Because they switched to a more scene graph type model for screen rendering. That's what gives you all the transparencies and all the goodies. There's a price to pay. Which is all these extra management of lifetime and ownership and basically making sure that all the data is handled properly at all times. So scene graphs are the data structure for 3D rendering. When you want it in a data structure. It's all the scene graph stuff that I've ever seen is hierarchical. It's hierarchical in two completely different ways. One of them is typically in the object-oriented way. So you have classes, like Node. And then you have children classes of the node, like transform a mesh and a scene. Okay. And then maybe you have children of those. It's a full hierarchy. Okay. The node class is the one that provides the interface for all those, which is general and generic. Right. And also, it is a hierarchy of objects. So we have the hierarchy of classes, of types, and the hierarchy of objects, of values. Okay. So you usually have some root node, which is the scene. You know, this is my entire scene. And you can pass that around. You know, it's a piece of data, like any other. And that will have a list of things that are visible on the scene, right? So every subtree here is one thing. And nodes are quite often put in the middle. So that this tree structure can be traversed in a meaningful manner. So what this transform node says is, oh, I'm gonna set the world transform, for instance, for this object. So when you traverse and render the transform, you know, it just sets the world transform, right? And then calls render on the child. And then when it comes out, you know, it like clears out that world transform. In some way. I mean, there's, we'll talk a little more about that sort of thing. So that's basically, in a nutshell, what a scene graph is, right? This is just about rendering. It doesn't say anything about AI. You know, like, which moves objects in the world, right? It doesn't say about, you know, the physical aspects of the objects. It doesn't say anything about anything beyond rendering. Okay.
So the code that Dan gave us, I think, where he has the node.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, you know, I was kind of going through the slides before coming here. And then I realized, oh my goodness, this is from a previous year, and I think Dan changed it on me and didn't even tell me. Which is funny. So this was the class hierarchy on a previous year. This year is a little different. There's no sphere node. There is a mesh node. There's no array node. So it's all different. Okay. Basically, there is right now what you have is a model specification and a model node. That model node can contain different types of models, like the world node, you know, world model, and so on. So it has changed, I think, for the better. But so don't look at this very closely. You know, you can look at it as an example of something that has happened for real. So I haven't had a chance to look more closely at how the AI part of it, you know, which is very important in your game projects, because Steve wants to use it, okay, extensively. So how it links to this hierarchy, you know, that you have in your games, right? Typically, what ends up happening is you have two hierarchies that kind of match, right? So the multi-level structure of the hierarchy doesn't, but ultimately all the leaves of one hierarchy are kind of linked to the leaves of the other one. So you have your scene, right? And then you have, without going into the levels, you know, you have a model one and a model two and a model three, right? Say the ground, the teapot, and the billboard, right, in your scene, for instance. And then you have your, you know, AI kind of structure, right? And this will have controllers, right? So this is a controller, like a teapot controller, right? And this will be a billboard controller or something, you know, and it basically decides what the billboard does. In this case, you know, I mean, the billboard wouldn't do anything, but it could, right? And in here, there will be pointers. to visible objects. So that when the artificial intelligence part of the game says, oh, the teapot now, you know, entered hyperspace, right? Or, you know, just started moving in that direction, right? It can update the world matrices that get used here, right? So, and the way all these linkages work, you know, it's basically a case-by-case basis. There's no standardized way of thinking about this. You know, there's a sort of standardized way of thinking about the structure of this, but not how it interacts with the rest of the game. In many ways, that sort of structure comes from the graphics designer kind of world. When you save out, you know, you run 3D Studio Max or Lightwave or one of those modeling packages, and you know, you make, you know, awesome spaceship or something, and you save it out. You know, what it saves out is something like this, you know, a data structure that represents everything that goes in that object. Oh, it has these parts with different textures and different shaders and different things. So it all has to be specified. And they typically use a tree structure kind of similar to what syngraphs do. In OpenGL, you know, there's been like standardized way of doing syngraphs for a long time. It's not part of OpenGL, but it's like companion type of libraries. D3D, a long time ago, tried to do that, and it didn't sit well with developers. It was called retain mode. You know, D3D, a long time ago, I'm talking about D3.5, or I'm not sure if it was in 6. They had immediate mode and retain mode. Immediate mode is what we've been working with. You know, draw index primitive. You know, whatever you do in order to get all the states correctly set is your problem. And they had retain mode, which was a bit, you know, kind of syngraph like this. So there have been attempts, but in the end, especially with Direct3D, there is no standardized way. And different people do it this differently. Okay. Sometimes the syngraph is only used for part of the rendering. Like, games typically have two very, very different parts. One of them is the world that gets rendered, and another part is all the health bars and HUDs and crosshairs and all those things that have nothing to do with the 3D world. The overlays. So those can be, like, the scene, you know, the 3D world could be rendered with a scene graph, and then the overlays might be just, you know, code hitting draw index primitive directly. That would be okay. Questions so far? Okay. So you could think, you know, why do things this way, right? And to some people, it is the only logical way of doing it. to do things through data, especially people who are more design-oriented. When you're a programmer, you know, having to manage a data structure is often more complex than just doing things directly, especially when everything is linear, ultimately. You know, D3D is a linear kind of API. It's not hierarchical in nature or anything like that. You set state, draw, set state, draw, set state, draw.
Well, that's kind of what would happen anyway, so just when you get that in one, you set some states and then draw, and then when you get that in two, you set some state and draw.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, this is a scene graphs, you know, one of the things why people like them is that they're a more structured way of laying out the rendering. I mean, just imagine, okay, you have a city, right? And, you know, you want to model something like, you know, an alien blows up a whole neighborhood, right? And that's a whole bunch of buildings and so on. Well, if you make the whole neighborhood be some sort of node, okay, with all the buildings hanging off of it, then, you know, stop making it so it doesn't render it anymore. It's just removing it from the hierarchy, right? Or maybe inserting some sort of node that, you know, like a visibility node that you can turn on and off. Right. So that when the rendering is traversing the structure, you know, goes into the visibility, says, you know, visibility, right? Render yourself. And it says, oh, but I'm not visible. So return. Done.
Microsoft installer is data driven.
Yeah. There are many, like, tools and libraries that, you know, do this sort of thing for various purposes. Okay. WPF, yes. Silverlight. WPF. You know, they're the same thing. And yes, it is a sync graph. You know, you're manipulating a data structure in order to render. So, one nice thing about having a data structure is that you can save it out to disk. Right? You can say, hey, you know, I have this scene. You can save it out. And then load it again. And if everything is properly implemented, you can go ahead and render it. It's great for debugging. Just imagine, I mean, you have your testers playing your game and suddenly something goes amiss, right, in the graphics. They can go and say, you know, push a button, say, save the scene graph right now. And then put it, you know, attach it to the bug. And so when a programmer gets to look at it, you know, they can actually just grab that and load it up and get it to render and see what the problem was. Nice and easy. So there are definite benefits to working with data structures as opposed to code. There is no way to save, like, the state of the executable program, you know, the whole thing. You know, there's no real good way to do that. You know, there are too many variables, too many different things that participate in what it is the current state of the program.
Do some of the graphics engines, like Real or Unreal, make this possible, or is the same graph with those fine?
Honestly, I've never used one of those, so I'm not entirely sure how they work. I am pretty sure that they offer this sort of thing, even if it's optional. I mean, they might have their own abstraction on top of D3E, which is not data-driven. That's also entirely possible. So, again, you know, this is how 3D Studio, Max, and Maya, and all those things work. There are, you know, those are the problems of flexibility, right? Suddenly, if you say, oh, but I want to render these, you know, three different ways depending on, you know, the mood of the player or something, right? And so, now you have to create a node, hook it up, manage it, you know, it's a lot more complicated than just, you know, putting a piece of code saying, you know, switch, you know, and it's a different state.
Or exploring part of M2 and M3 neighborhoods. Because there's an overlap sometimes in between. You can't just...
Yeah. So again, you know, when you just want to have a system where you can post stuff to be rendered, and not have to worry, you know, this is perfect. When you want full flexibility of changing everything to improve the game, then this is, you know, the more structured that your code and data is, the harder it is to do radical modifications to it. So we have, you know, the three elements that I explained. You know, there's the class hierarchy, the tree structure of, you know, which is basically like a tree of pointers, and the traversal strategies. You know, those are the three main things of any hierarchical structure. And the traversal strategies is just, you know, what you want to do with the whole thing. And the two typical ones are, you know, the render. You know, you want to draw the scene, or the update. You know, you want to run any, you know, update the state of everything in the scene. That's when you have your nodes actually handle their own animation and that sort of thing, right? And there are as many styles as there are game engines out there. And there are many. I mean, the middleware ones are a few, but many game development companies out there still make their own. So I just wanted to give you some examples of scene graphs and how they get used. Okay. These transform nodes, typically what they do is they actually manage a stack of world transformations, or a stack of transformations, I should say. The idea here is that we want to have an articulated object, like a robot, right? And we have like the body, and then the arms, and then the fists, and we have the legs, and we have the head, right? And when the body gets moved, everything goes with it, right? So when the world matrix of the body changes, then the world matrix of the arms and the legs and the head will also change. And that's very conveniently represented as a hierarchy, right? When a mesh world position and orientation depends on another one, then we just put it as a child of the other one's transform. That's all. Then when the hierarchy is being traversed to render the scene, what happens is this first transform, which is like the transform of the entire robot, will get pushed on the stack and will become the world matrix. And then it goes and renders this first mesh, say the body, right? And then it goes and says, oh, I have another transform. You know, it's just going like this, like this, like this, right? Just traversing the tree. So it goes and says, oh, there's another transform. So that's basically something in the body that has to move not only with its own transformation, but also if the body moves, it also needs to move. So it gets multiplied, right? Wait, why do I have this in your order? Oh, because this is mesh too. So if this is the new transform that is dependent on the first one, then we just need to multiply the matrices. Right? Basically, the vertices of that mesh have to be moved with their own transform, and then with the body. So this is the new world transform for, say, the head. And same thing for all the others. And this thing can be as deep as needed. I mean, this phalanx over here depends on this one, which depends on this one, which depends on the wrist, which depends on the elbow, right? So it can be very deep.
Or you can do a bulldozer where the root is the body of the bulldozer and you have the shovel going up and down.
Yeah, going up and down, and then maybe, you know, the paddle goes also, you know, swivels in its own. Yes. So, and this is generally what you always need to do when you are doing these sort of skeletal hierarchical structures of objects. I mean, even if it's something as simple as a fighter plane that moves the wings, right? You know, one of those funny ones that go supersonic. Exactly the same thing. The wings go with the plane, right? And they just have their own movement within the plane. So this is one of the scenarios where this sort of hierarchy actually makes a lot of sense. One nice thing about this is, oh, I've thrown a sticky grenade and it hit his hand, which is here. Okay, so then you can just go ahead and add the grenade here and we'll get, you know, as I go, oh no, I want to get out of, you know, the grenade kind of moves with my hand automatically. Automatically even, you know. So that's the type of thing where this actually makes a lot of sense. Another example is for managing state. So you could make every single last piece of state. You could make it into a node. Usually you would group them somehow. Like, oh, all the blend states, you know, it's like you can make a node that's a certain blending mode. The Z buffer states there. In a way, you know, the world matrix is just one of those pieces of state. But you can extend it to everything. So, for instance, you could have a scene with three different meshes, and one of them is alpha-blended. This really looks like the hardware render with the transparent teapot, right? You have the the ground, and then the teapot, and then the billboard, which are actually rendered in this order, right? So, if I had the scene set up, so, you know, this mesh gets a transform and also gets an alpha blending mode, then as I'm rendering, you know, coming in here, it will actually set the alpha blending mode, render the mesh. When coming out, it will restore whatever alpha blending mode was before. So that then this mesh 3 is just rendered opaque normally. Okay. Again, this is a bad thing. You know, alpha blending should be done all at the end, right? This is the wrong sorting, but it happens. If you're not careful. There are more esoteric kind of structures. So there are techniques that require you to render your scene more than once. Or maybe render a portion of your scene more than once. One of those cases is when you have a mirror. When you have a mirror, then there are pieces of geometry that you can see from two different angles, right? Directly and through the mirror. That means they have to be rendered twice in order to get that to happen.
Would this also work for portal? Would this also work for portal? You can see through the portal and
you
can get into an infinite loop, like a TV.
Yeah. Yeah. It is possible, yes. Basically, what you have is a portal sort of node, and it has the scene behind it. And that's... So those, like, local scenes, you know, scene portions or fragments, you know, could actually end up being in multiple places in the tree. Because they can be seen directly or through a portal. Yes. The case that I'm representing here is shadow mapping. Okay, and again, we'll talk about shadowing next week, but shadow mapping consists on rendering the entire scene into a shadow buffer texture. From the point of view of the light. So that then we can figure out what parts of the scene are in shadow and what parts are not. So it requires setting up the shadow map render targets, rendering the entire scene, right? And then set up the regular render targets and then rendering the scene again there. And while rendering here, it'll somehow be using this texture that we just rendered into in order to do the shadows. This is one of the cases where it starts getting complicated, the whole ownership thing. I mean, is there anybody here who does not know what I mean when I talk about ownership in object-oriented programming? Anybody does not know? Okay. So you can see how, you know, it can get a little more complicated to handle that ownership correctly. If you're a Java programmer or C-sharp programmer, or one of those, then it's less of a problem. Garbage collection takes care of it. But it being less of a problem does not mean that it is not a problem at all. So, there was a long time ago, a few people that wrote a book. The book is usually called the Group of Four book, because there's four authors. Design Patterns is the name. Okay. Doesn't have anything to do with games. You know, it's just about object-oriented patterns. Okay. Saying, hey, you know, sometimes you need to do things like this. So this is how you do it, right? And it's basically a recipe book, you know, of like 40 different recipes of object-oriented, patterns. and, you know, it's a seminal book. It's great. It's not the end-all of programming or anything like that. But, you know, it helped me, at least, you know, begin to understand how to tackle this sort of thing correctly. There's one of the patterns that I have in there, which is called the visitor pattern. Some of you might have heard of it. So the visitor pattern is precisely about structures like this. When you have an object-oriented hierarchical structure, you have a duality, right, of different nodes that you have and different operations that you want to do with those nodes, you know, when traversing. Okay, and the two don't mix very well in regular object-oriented languages. They just don't. Object-oriented languages make adding new types of nodes easy, right, and make adding new type of traversals very hard, because usually the traversal is just a method within the objects. So when you add a new traversal, you have to modify every node correctly. Whereas when you want to add a new node, you just need to make it, and it's the change is local. There are other ways of doing this sort of thing, which, of course, in object-oriented languages, they are a little awkward, you know, but that may, you know, make things exactly the opposite, which is, you know, adding a new type of data is harder, but adding a new type of traversal is easier, right? And, so there is basically, what this means is, you know, they're not orthogonal. They do different things, you know, in programming languages today. They're not orthogonal. You cannot make it so that you can manipulate this whole shebang easily, no matter what you try to do. You know, there is always something that suffers. Either it's very easy to manipulate the traversals, or it's very easy to manipulate the nodes, but not both. Okay. So anyway, it's just one of those gotchas. When you go to more, you know, less structured solutions, you know, those gotchas tend to not matter so much. You know, everything becomes easier. So, especially with some types of games where you know ahead of time everything that's ever gonna go in the game. You know, it might be better not to go through with something very generic like this and just code in functions, you know, all the things that your game needs to do when rendering. Because it's not going to be that many. You know, when you have a racing game, you have the track, any backgrounds, right? The track, the cars, which are all pretty much the same, and very little more, actually, to render. When you have a game like Halo, then, you know, as the player goes through levels, there are all sorts of different things that get rendered in all sorts of combinations. And that's where something like this becomes a little more desirable. Okay. Same thing with puzzle games. You know, I would never do this for Bejeweled. Just this does not happen for Bejeweled. Okay? It's just not reasonable, in my opinion. I mean, you are going to have a structure for the jewels. It's probably going to be a two-dimensional array or something like it. Okay, it's not going to be a hierarchy of objects.
Or mind field or chess.
Exactly. Puzzle games in general, you know, tend to be very simple in what they render. And even if they're not entirely simple, you know, they tend to be very regimented, and, you know, just in what it is that you're rendering. So adding structure in a different way, you know, just fights with it and provides no real benefit. Probably the game that used a scene graph that I've seen with less reason was the original Fable. You know, I had the chance to work on that game for a couple months, you know, helping them out, and they were using a very structured kind of rendering system. And it was just hard to deal with. You know, there's... Fable? No. No, Fable is an action RPG type game. It's a bit of a sandbox in that you have freedom of movement, but it's not... That's not the focus of it. So, yeah. I mean, in general, many RPG games, you know, tend to be sandboxy in nature. Just because, you know, role-playing games are, you know, are all about choice, right? So, in order to have choice, you cannot have a single, like, linear path through the game. It just doesn't work that way. I think we'll take a look at Fable next week, because it goes with the shadowing, you know, it's kind of interesting how it does it. So these connections, okay, connections between the scene graph and the rest of the game can be fragile. You know, I've seen one problem we had at one point in Fable is that somebody was, you know, like starting a fire, right? You know, goes with a candle and puts it on a stack of hay, and you know, started, you know, the fire started on it and then it never went away. It's like, you know, the scripting part that says, oh, when you put fire close to a brick of hay, you know, it should light on fire. You know, that logic was there, but then nothing ever removed that fire effect object from the scene graph. You know, it's just a little mistake. You know, forgot to remove it from there at some point. Okay, so you could go through the game and lighting everything on fire, and it, you know, the whole thing would go down and just too much fire, right? in the tree.
Oh.
You know, for performance, you know, it was bad. You know, it's like a memory leak. A very slow one, maybe, but... There was... And those sorts of things actually ended up, you know, I mean, everything in that game was very structured like this. And so you could actually do very crazy things, like, this little town that was near a pirate camp, right? So usually, you know, the request that had you go from that town, you know, into the pirate camp through it, you know, kind of befriend the pirates and that sort of thing, and fight them. And somebody figured out, hey, you know, I can actually go through the pirate camp, you know, get all the pirates to want to kill me, right? And then run back into the town. And all the pirates would follow. All of them. Okay? So at some point you would have a town full of people and pirates, right? And the pirates would start, like, you know, killing everybody. And, you know, the performance would be horrible, because there were no limits. There were just too many people. You know, there was nothing limiting it. And they would kill everybody in town, and then you could go ahead and take over all the houses and get money for them. And, you know, it was just silly, right? Instead of you killing them and getting all the fines and losing all the karma, you know, that would lose you no karma, right? Anyway, and in many ways that's awesome. You know, that's the kind of emergent behavior that comes from structure, right? Structure that allows many, many, many variations. You know, if you have a function, you know, just a code function that goes and says, I'm going to render this and this and this and this, then, you know, there is nothing but that, right? You cannot grow. A tree structure like this, or, you know, a controller AI structure like this, or any sort of structured internal representation of the universe for the game, right? You know, allows for a lot of variation, and well used can be excellent for those types of games, right? Another thing that I've seen many people get, I'm not sure if wrong is the word, but not right, maybe, not entirely right, is, you know, this separation between static data and dynamic data. And that's one of the things that has gotten better in the game project from previous years. Mm. So, this scene graph, okay, is just a list of the things that get rendered, okay? It is entirely possible to have one thing rendered more than once, right? You can do that by having things like these transform nodes, right? So you can have it mesh, say, a bottle, right? And you could have that mesh multiple times in the hierarchy, you know, with different transforms, right? So you have, you know, you have a bar and it's got 100 bottles, right, or something. Okay, so you could have 100 bottles like that with only one copy of the mesh. As long as this node is a static node, it's something that never changes, right? I mean, it's just a pile of vertices and indices and, you know, just the logic that binds them together. Okay. And these transforms are the ones that change from frame to frame. Hmm. I've seen people break that sort of thing constantly. One example has been actually the Direct Sound API. For the longest time, Direct Sound, which is the equivalent of Direct 3D, but for sound, for audio, was such that you would load a sound, which is big piece of data, you know, a wave file or something, you know, and at runtime in the game, you know, what it meant is you load the sound and then you say, sound, play yourself, right? Play yourself. Now, the problem is that if you had a sound that represents an explosion, okay, and in your game there are multiple explosions at the same time, one over here, one over there, well, you can only play one because it's just an explosion, right? If you want multiple explosions, then you need to load it twice. Exactly the same data. Exactly the same data so that you can play it twice. You know, that's bad. Yeah, but the thing is, you know, the mix is a dynamic thing. You know, what you want is to have piece of data, and then a player for a piece of data. Right? And then you have only one piece of data and two sort of players, two channels, two controllers, you know, pulling from the same piece of data. So yeah, at some point they put in a clone method to the sound so that you could say, oh, you know, just generate another sound, but under the hood, they actually will share the same data. That's a hack. You know, eventually it's all fixed, but you know, now with Exadia and everything, you know, everything is the way it's supposed to be. But again, you know, even the best of people can get this type of thing wrong. I mean, you load a mesh, and you shouldn't be modifying it ever. If there's any chance that you might want to render it more than once in a scene. At least. Things like deformable meshes, you know, you blow up a building and suddenly, you know, one chunk comes out, but the rest is there. You know, some modification of the mesh. You know, those things have to be thought out ahead of time and properly implemented. Because if you want to have a whole city, you probably want to repeat the same building in multiple places. And you don't want to have repeated version of the data, of the vertices and the indices. And the textures and... So that's that for scene graphs. Let's do a 10-minute break. So 20 minutes to 8. We come back. Yes.
So I did what you said. Turn said Z right, enable false.
Mm-hmm.
And so now it works. Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering why does it work? Because the opaque things that are in front of the particles obscure the particles when they're in front of them, and when the particles are in front of the opaque things.
Mm-hmm.
So
wait.
So it works, right? It's as if the things have a distance. They're not, you know, in infinite distance or anything.
Mm-hmm.
So it works fine, but I don't understand. If I'm not ready for the Z-buffer, how does it know that these particles are in front of all this stuff?
In front of all that stuff?
Yeah.
You mean in front of the floor, in front of everything?
And those spaceships, yeah.
Two things. One of them, you're rendering them after.
Yeah.
You're rendering the other stuff.
Right.
And second... You are, when rendering the particles, you are actually doing Z-buffer testing. You're just not writing new values to the Z-buffer.
Ah.
There is a Z-enable and a Z-write-enable. Okay. Z-enable is for testing.
Ah,
Z-write-enable.
I left the Z-enable true. I just the Z-write-enable false. So that's what's doing it. So it can tell if the particles are in front. And so it renders them,
but it doesn't write
the Z-buffer.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. There's
already a Z-buffer that expresses, because you've rendered all the opaque stuff.
All the opaque stuff.
There's already a Z-buffer that contains the information about the three-dimensional blockers
in the whole scene. Except for these opaque particles.
So you can render new things. You can render new things, and... If they're behind a pillar or behind a building, they will not show up.
Interesting. Okay.
Are you changing the alpha at all?
No. The alpha.
No.
Is
are you animating the alpha?
No.
Okay. Because I'm thinking of doing smoke with a changing alpha.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You could do that, but the alpha for here is coming from that.
Well, the texture I'm going to use is going to have some alpha because, you know, it's a square texture.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll round it off in some fashion.
Yeah.
But anyway,
you can always provide an alpha in your vertices or in a constant in order to phase them out.
I wasn't trying to represent anything in particular here. It's just a
generic
part of
fun.
Doesn't represent real at all.
What happens when it hits? Does it do anything when it hits the ground?
Yeah, they bounce. Mm-hmm. You can't tell when they're this big. I only made them this big. I mean, they're meant to be small so that you can see them bouncing.
It doesn't seem like they're bouncing very hard.
Mm-hmm.
When they're small, they don't want to be outside.
I was wondering if you had a chance to look at what I turned in for homework 5. I had a few questions. So with tiny, you have that light vector. Is that the only way to light up tiny is using some of those things?
Okay.
Yeah. I'll have to look more into that. Is there a way to apply multiple lights to tiny? No.
Not with the share you have, no.
Okay.
But you can rewrite that shader.
Wow.
Well, the Tiny's not using the shader. I don't set the vertex shader.
Multi-animation FX.
Yeah, that's being used as an effects file with ID3DX effect.
As written, it doesn't pass in any byte density in any direction, so you have to
rewrite. Okay.
I wouldn't.
Modify it?
Exactly. I wouldn't modify it.
Because my intention is to have spotlights.
So yeah, eliminating down from the ceiling of the factory.
Right.
Yes. What I said in one email.
Yeah, I think I remember that. I was wondering if that was the only way to do it.
It's never the only way to do it.
Right.
This is computers. In computers, there's always at least three different ways of doing anything, including scrolling in a web page.
Right. Now, for the evil drone mesh, what I did is I saw that you had that convert mesh function in homework renderer, so I naively just copied it.
Mm-hmm.
That didn't work. It produced an object that looked weird. Then I noticed that the data stored in the mesh was positioned normal in text cores. So I just copied those over, set the diffuse in my world vertex, and it worked fine.
Mm-hmm.
Were you saying that was overkill, or was a better way to do it? Just leave it as it was and just set the render state?
Change the shader. The vertex shader main function gets inputs, right?
Yeah.
Just make sure that it only has as inputs the things that are actually in your vertices.
Mm-hmm.
If your vertex shader wants a specular vertex color,
right,
and your vertices don't have one, use a zero.
Right.
You can even have, I mean, you can define your own functions in shaders. So you can have your shader be one function, right? That does everything and that has parameters.
Right.
And then you can have different techniques that reference different vertex shaders that have different sets of inputs and set the rest of inputs as, you know, the inputs as constants, you know, basically as defaults, and then calls the function that does the work.
Right, but your vertex buffer has to be the same structure, and you just have parameters or flags in it.
Mm-hmm. The vertex buffer can be, in many ways,
whatever you want.
Anything. Mm-hmm. Whatever you want or whatever you're given. Mm-hmm. What I'm saying is it's much easier to change the vertex shader so it matches that than it is to actually change the data.
I guess I'm missing something, so... I could have just used the same vertex shader to get the fuse from somewhere else and use what I had. I would have to define a new world vertex or set it beforehand to something. In this case, I just set it to the material had a diffuse. There was a material with evil drone and it had a diffuse value, and that's what I shoved in there.
Mm-hmm.
But for this assignment, you did want us to use a vertex shader and a pixel shader of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
In most cases, correct?
No, I did not say that I needed you to use a shader.
Okay.
I do recommend it.
Mm-hmm.
Strongly recommend it.
Okay.
Because in many ways, it's easier. Once you get the hang of it, it is easier. And, you know, shaders are the present. They're not even the future or anything like that. You know, it's the way things work today with all GPUs that are built and sold today.
You know, but currently, you know, if you want to add some lights, we have to change the shader to be able to handle that.
Because
there's nothing there to other than what we put, whereas, you know, if we just do it with the fixed function pipeline, that's taken care of. With the right lights and flags.
I mean, for shader management, there are games out there that maybe use 3,000 different shaders.
So they're constantly saying set vertex shaders and pixel shaders to different things.
Maybe they don't use 3,000 at the same time in the same frame, right? But they could be rendering any of a whole number of meshes that in total, you know, could end up using thousands of shaders. There is shader management, you know, is another topic that I haven't even started breaching, and I won't, really. But there are games out there that build the shaders, the shader source code, from pieces, from fragments, at runtime.
And then compile it.
Because that gives the most flexibility to artists. Basically, they define a sort of virtual shader with lots of parameters. Numbers of lights, types of materials, different combinations of textures that, you know, they can specify parameters on. You know, parameters can be in textures, they can be in vertices, they can be in constants. So, if you want to give your artists full freedom, then, you know, the best and only way is to actually link in your shaders at runtime. And the only way to do that with the 3.9 is to actually link up pieces of strings that make up the source code for a shader. And then have a cache of compiled shaders. Of course, you don't want to be compiling them over and over again.
Right.
I mean, compiling a shader can be a half a second if you're not careful.
Right. That's something you want to preload.
Yeah, or not preload, but, you know, do on demand, but with a pre-caching scheme. I mean, even if you are, you know, many games out there also do streaming of assets, of textures, of and geometry, and things like that. So that not all of it has to be in memory at the same time.
I'm just thinking,
they just have queues that say, oh, you know, you're getting close to this area, so better start loading the textures that go in that area that you don't have.
I'm thinking in Halo, you have those choke points. Where it always says load.
Well, in Halo and many, many games, yes. In racing games, you know, the choke point is the track itself, right? It's linear. You know, it's just going in a loop, right? So, makes everything easy. You know, you cross a certain line, and suddenly it starts loading what comes after. So, skeletal animation. Okay, let's learn about how to make a proper character. Proper person. And there's gonna be math in here. Okay. Yes. So, you know, I'll just try to get through it. So everybody gets what I'm talking about. Hopefully. I'm just warning you because from my previous experience, you know, it's kind of hard to follow at one point. I guess Alex can tell exactly how hard it was. So, a skeleton is just a structure of bones. And these bones are not anything visible, right? They are like virtual entities, okay? They're not even the bones of the characters themselves. You know, like the ulna and the femur and all those bones. No. Okay? They are a representation of the parts of a body, of an object, that have some sort of rigid movement. And in the human body, those are the bones, and that's why they're called bones. Okay? Those bones will be defined, you know, usually following some sort of standard position, you know, for people, it's typically this position, right? Feet not completely together, you know, somewhat separated. Of course, not, you know, doing those things that little girls do. You know, just comfortable, and the arms kind of extended to both sides. And, you know, head up, looking straight, and everything is, they call it the Jesus pose. Okay? Some people call it like that. General term is the rest pose. You know, it's the pose that your meshes are going to have when there's nothing moving them, nothing positioning them. Okay? So, every bone is kind of like a separate mesh within these sort of arrangement, kind of like. In reality, what each bone represents is one frame of reference. So we have a whole bunch of frames of references of frames of reference over there. Just for this simple character, it doesn't have hands, it doesn't have feet. Okay.
We're not articulating this one.
Okay. I mean, you can. This is just for show. Okay. This is just for the slides. Right. Again, it is possible to just make a character that does interesting things just with this. You know, everybody ever had one of those toys, which is, you know, an articulated character on a pedestal? Okay. Artists typically, you know, kind of learn with those about human poses and things like that. And, you know, this is kind of similar. So, the idea is that we're going to animate all those bones. And we're going to get pieces of geometry attached to each one of those bones. There might be some bones that don't have any. They're just sort of linkage bones. Right? But, in general, you know, bones will have a piece of geometry that moves with them. So, when this bone moves, you know, the forearm, the actual visible mesh will move with it. Okay? So, these bones, okay, they actually are arranged hierarchically. Okay, there's always going to be one bone that all the other bones kind of hang off of. And typically that's the body, the torso, for characters. Right? Why do I point to, you know, the lower part of the body? Because, you know, you usually do like this, right? You know, you don't kind of, you know, keep your chest straight and move your hips like this, right? You know, this is less natural, right? Typically, this part down here, up here, okay? is the one that the whole body kind of pivots on. Some people like to have it higher because the center of gravity of a person is more like here than it is down here. But, you know, nobody agrees on everything perfectly, right? So the main idea here is that when we have a hierarchy like this, okay, we might want to move the child bone, say 45 degrees up like that. Just imagine this is the arm, right? So that means moving like this. And then I might want to move this part of the arm down. And it drags the child bone with it. Okay. In this case, the child bone ends up being in the same direction that it was originally, right? Just because the two movements kind of cancel each other over here. So my forearm will end up in a different place, but the same orientation, even though it was rotated. Okay. And that's precisely what hierarchical animation is. I already told you how it is done in general. Okay? Which is, there's a matrix that moves this, there's a matrix that moves this, and the, you know, the matrices just get multiplied. child, then parent. If you do OpenGL, it's parent, then child, right? Remember, they use a different system. So in the end, what this means is, you know, this part moves in relation to this one. This part over here moves in relation to this one. You know, these bones that I have here, you know, they're kind of just outlines of bones because they're not real. You know, nothing really moves them. You know, what this means is there is a shoulder over here. Okay. And this is where it pivots. And it is a child of this bone here. So in some ways, this is kind of like for visualization, right? So you can see that it's actually linked. There are actually good ways sometimes to have bones that have their own movement. Like, you know, you can do this, right? Even though there's no real body part attached to, you know, to that particular movement. Okay, what happens is I'm moving the pivot point of this bone over here, right? Moving it up and down. And sometimes that, you know, that's actually very useful to express like this. But ultimately, okay, moving the pivot point of a frame of reference, of a bone, of a local space, what it means is just a translation, right? With this, I'm just translating this entire bone up and down. So I could do it as making this a child of this bone and having this bone kind of spin up and down, or I could just encode that translation directly on this bone here. Right? So again, this is just different styles of visualizing this sort of thing. When you talk to an artist, you know, typically they'll have these sorts of things because it's good for them. You know, they can make movable parts that do not really represent anything at runtime in your game. But they make them so that it's easier for them to create the animations. And some people will end up actually putting them in runtime even though they just waste performance and it could have been done differently. Okay. So this is where the math begins. When we try to implement this sort of thing, okay, let's do it slowly, okay? So the idea here is that we have these three bones. This is bone A, which is the root bone, and bones B and C, which are children of bone A, okay? And, you know, just imagine that there is a rotation that is applied to a bone, right? Like, so this rotation over here is just rotating bone C around its own pivot point. So the world transforms here, okay, for any mesh that is attached to bone A is going to be some matrix A which represents the location of this bone within the overall model that we are rendering. Okay. So if we have a robot, right, then we use some world transform to place that robot in the world. And then there is a bone inside of that robot and it moves. And that's what this A means. It's the matrix that we have defined for that particular bone locally to the robot. Yes?
So A is a model space at rest position. And W is just how you move the model within the world. But it's still in the rest position, just somewhere else in some orientation. And that's what W represents. Is that correct?
Okay, I'm not
Okay, so you're in rest position.
Mm-hmm.
And let's say this is A.
Yeah.
So this is A. And then I move my torso to over there facing that way, that would be W. So to see his arm over there, it would be A times W.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, in a way, you know, with the way to see this is that each one of these bones creates its own frame of reference, okay, centered in its pivot point, maybe, and then with axis kind of follow the bones, right? So you could have the same mesh for this arm, even though they point different ways. Why? Because they're applied to bones that have different frames of reference. Once you go through these operations, okay, they will both be placed in different sizes of the body. Okay. So for bone B, B's matrix is actually, this B matrix over here, is actually the matrix that transforms from the frame of reference of this bone into the frame of reference of its parent. So in order to move the forearm, okay, I have to get this mesh, okay, transform it into the frame of reference of its parent. And its parent. And then ultimately put it in the world. Okay. Okay. Now, imagine that I say, oh, I'm just gonna spin my forearm by 45 degrees up or something, right? I'm going to apply a rotation to one of the bones. Just apply a rotation to one of the bones. Like that. So this is what these R represents, right? So basically what we need is this new sort of C matrix, right? Which takes whatever mesh is applied to bone C. Spins it in its own, in, you know, in the C bone local space, and then moves it back the chain, right? So you would have this new, world matrix for the C bone. Which now has this rotation attached to it. Okay. If I want to animate multiple bones, like I want to animate a child and a parent, okay, then the rotation matrix for each bone goes next to the, you know, goes right before the matrix that moves from that frame of reference to the parents. In a way, you can see that because, you know, I'm applying M after going off of, you know, from bone C's, after applying, C's rotation and applying C's frame of reference, basically dragging the whole thing, like dragging the entire space of C by that rotation. Okay. Questions so far? Yes.
So, just to make sure, so for A, its origin would be its pivot point in its local space, and B, its pivot point would be its zero or origin in its local space, and then transform B times A would kind of move that pivot up and rotate it to get it into the skeleton at rest position, and then by W to move it in the world.
Honestly,
you're rotating over
different people kind of visualize this differently. Okay. I kind of visualize it slightly opposite, as you're saying, which is what this thing is representing. Okay, it's just a moving of this mesh, which is applied to bone C. Okay, right. Moving it from C space to A space,
right.
And then from there to world space. So particularly going from here all the way down. You were talking about, you know, kind of moving the pivot point, you know, from point to tail.
Because I'm thinking rotations usually want to be around the origin.
So yeah. I mean, C's local space is something that you can define. Anybody can define. Okay. The only trick to it is that the mesh that gets attached to C is defining that space.
So if I'm rotating this, I don't want to rotate it around this origin because then it gets...
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, you choose those local spaces so that these matrices that you apply typically are just rotation matrices, which is great because then you can use quaternions. If there are matrices with translation, then you need the quaternion and the translation. You know, everything, right? So yeah, I mean, typically the stuff is designed so that each bone just pivots around its joint, its pivot point. Okay? This bone pivots around this pivot point.
Like my shoulder is bulging, so I can go this way, whereas my elbow can just go this axis.
Mm-hmm.
And those are both 3D rotations. One's 2D and one's 3D rotations.
Yep. Again, the nature of these R transformation really doesn't matter. It could be anything. It could be scale. Yeah, it could have translation. It could have shares if you absolutely need to, which you don't. Ever. Okay. So M is just saying, oh, now I'm gonna move, you know, I'm gonna do something to the A bone. Say, pivot it this way. And M is that matrix that represents that movement, that rotation or translation or whatever it is. Of the bone itself. Again, you know, quite often, you know, the parentmost object does not have a matrix because the model space is the same as the space of that bone. Like, you know, you might just as well have the root bone be how the model is defined, not have it be something inside of the hierarchy. Again, it's a little like not having those bones here, you know, if they don't actually play anything in at runtime, if they don't add anything of value at runtime. Having this A matrix would be kind of like having a virtual bone that is at whatever is the origin of the local space of the model, right? But having a root bone means probably you don't have, you know, it's the same. So it would be the identity matrix, so you wouldn't write it. But I put it here just for explicity. Okay, so that you see the relationship between any parent and any child. Okay? More questions? Okay. So this works great, okay? When you're actually animating, you typically want to animate each bone separately. You know, like have a whole bunch of different animations that are completely independent from each other, okay? Makes them simpler. You know, this spins as a simple rotation. The axis is always the same. So you could actually encode it as angle. And then apply the axis somehow at runtime. Basically build a rotation matrix from the angle. You could do that. Once you have that matrix, then you have to bring it down through the hierarchy, through the skeleton. So that it can find world space. Right? Properly. But in the end, what you get is just a world matrix for every single bone. And those matrices They have been built using common components, so they're not completely independent. But once you have them, they are completely independent. Hmm? What you have is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 different meshes with 10 different world matrices. So when you render these meshes, you just render 10 different meshes with 10 different world matrices. Or if you've made it so this mesh is the same as this one because they are the same, only rotated, then you know, you only have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 different meshes with 10 world matrices, right? But it's all the same, right? It's all the same. It's just 10 different calls to draw index primitive or something. Okay. We could just as well just pre-compute all of this and have our character animation be 10 world matrices. Or maybe not world matrices, but everything but the world matrix, right? So you can place him in the world wherever you want, right? You could do that. Again, these matrices are much simpler than this ones, right? So that's why typically they're preferred, which means you are doing all of this at runtime. When you're skinning, things are a little stickier. The main reason for this is that there is only one mesh. There are still a whole bunch of world matrices, but there is only one mesh. One mesh that has been defined in one single common world space. Local space. I mean, in this case, this mesh is defined such that this bone is its local space, right? And this mesh over here is defined so that this bone is its local space. So the vertices from one mesh and the other one are in different frames of reference, in different spaces. The coordinates that are stored in the vertices, you know, are referring different frames of references. Frames of reference. That's what makes this enough. But when we have a single mesh where some of the vertices go with one of the bones, some other vertices go with some of the other bones, then either you have different vertices that are specified in different frames of reference within the same mesh. Or your math turns ever so slightly more complicated. Okay? And there are very good reasons to have all the vertices in the mesh defined in the same frame of reference. There are very good reasons for that. The main reason is that in order to get the skin to wrap correctly around the joints, you need to have some vertices that actually move with more than one bone. Okay. So, which bone would it be that it's defined in, right? I mean, one vertex accessing two bones, we have two different frames of reference. It just doesn't work. Okay. So, we end up just having one single mesh defined in one frame of reference. And that frame of reference is the root bone, or, you know, basically the model local space. Not the bone local spaces. And that's what requires this extra little transformation. Okay, so basically each vertex, before applying this like, you know, CW matrix that we just calculated before, before applying this matrix, each vertex has to be converted from the mesh frame of reference to the bone frame of reference. And then rotate it, and then convert it back all the way.
And that's yes. done for all the vertices in the mesh?
Yes. Ultimately, each vertex is just multiplied by one or more matrices. One or more world matrices. Okay. All of this, we're doing it like in the CPU. Setting it's the setting up of the world matrices. Okay? That's what it is. You know, it's just a complicated setup. Okay? This does not change the shader per se. What the shader does is it says, oh, I have a vertex. Which bone is it attached to? That's information that has to be stored in the vertices, by the way. Which bone is this vertex attached to? Oh, so I need this particular world matrix. And the shader gets an array of world matrices instead of only one.
So each vertex you record, whether it's attached to one or more vertices?
Yeah. I mean, the simplest case is its vertex is attached to one of the bones. That's the simplest case. There could be one triangle where all three vertices are attached to different bones. And that's where you see the skin stretching and deformation. But it is possible to just have a mesh where each vertex is attached to one of the bones. And there are maybe 10 different bones to choose from. Okay. So the shader gets an array of 10 world matrices. And the vertices have stored somehow an index of which of the world matrices should be used for that particular vertex. Through the use of that, we can have one single mesh where different parts move differently because they use different world matrices.
What's the math look like when one vertex is connected to two
matrices? The math is just a weighted average. So you transform the vertex by all the matrices that affect it, you know, and that gives you multiple world positions for the vertex. And then you just do a weighted average. That's the typical implementation. And the weights are also stored in the vertices. Its vertex says, oh, I'm like 30% this bone, 70% this one. They have to add up to one. Yes, you've been reading, or not? I put that in the homework description very explicitly.
So
yes,
this vertex will be affected by this bone and this bone. But that won't show like the bicep going up and down.
No, that has nothing to do with the bicep going up and down. That would be another bone or another
something. Mesh
deformation matrix math. That gets added to this whole shebang. Yes. Yes. Okay. So the idea is that these vertices, these vertices are specified in some space. Okay. The root space of the model. Okay. Remember, when we just attach a mesh to this bone here, we need to spin it to how this bone is moving, right? And then transform from this space, from this frame of reference to this one. And then maybe spin it if this one is moving, then transform from this frame of reference to the model, local frame of reference, which is what this final multiplication by this A matrix does. Once we have the local frame of reference, you know, once we have a vertex defined in the local frame of reference of the model, then we can apply the model's world matrix. Because the world is here and here, not there, right? Okay. So, that's if the mesh were defined in the local frame of reference of the bone. That's what we had here. Just mesh that's on the bone. And that's where this math comes in. So we have this C of W. Okay, the C world matrix. The world matrix for the bone C. Okay. The thing is that if our vertices are defined in the root, but they have to move with every tiny little nuance of any of some child bone, right? Like, I have this vertex. It's defined in the same frame of reference as my chest, but I need to move it with the movement of the finger, right? Then I need to transform it first from the frame of reference where it's defined to the frame of reference of this bone. I'm calling that, I'm calling the result of that is VC. Okay, this is the vertex defined in the local frame of reference of bone C. Okay. So that then I can just multiply it by the CW that I knew from before. It's the same thing. Okay. And that's the world vertex for my vertex V. Okay. The world position. Now, this VC is calculated as I have it defined in the root. I need to multiply it by the matrix that transformed from, you know, the root space, the local model space, to the parentmost, you know, the root bone. Remember, A transforms from the bone to its parent, from the root bone to the local model frame of reference. So the inverse of A transforms from that local model frame of reference into A bone, into the root bone frame of reference. Then the inverse of C transforms from these A, you know, from the parent bone frame of reference to the child bone frame of reference. Okay, so this VC is just the same vertex as V, but only defined in a different space. And I just need to multiply these in the reverse order as I do when I traverse down the hierarchy. Now I'm traversing up that hierarchy. So all the matrices are inverted and they're swapped, right? They're applied in the inverse order.
And R and M are never in the first half of the equation because you're just going from the model rest
exactly.
space to the model rest space.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Going back to model space.
Yeah. If you remember, yeah, if you remember in one of the math slides, I talked about the matrix sandwich. That's to apply some transformation in a frame of reference, which is not the one where what's being applied to is defined in. So I have a vertex defined in one frame of reference, and then I have a transformation that applies in a different frame of reference. You know, so what you need to do is get the inverse of going from, you need to get the transformation that goes from where it's defined to where, you know, where the vertex is defined to where the transformation is defined, apply the transformation, and then get the inverse of that to go back out. And so this is what this is, right? You have a transformation which is applied in the frame of reference of bone C. Okay, but something is defined outside of that frame of reference, so I just need to move it in, apply a transformation, and move it back out. And that's why it ends up with a structure kind of like this. Yes?
If we look at tiny and any examples that go with it, is that a good example of how to do this?
No. No. Tiny is an excellent example of looking at the shader and seeing how an array of matrices can be applied and that sort of thing. You know, it's a good example. It uses an effect. It doesn't use shaders. You know, it uses the effect parameter API in order to access the actual constants of the shaders instead of using set vertex shader constant. So there are differences, but at least the shader part, you know, is appropriate. You know, it supports two different bones per vertex with weights. You know, it does all that.
And the direct check samples, is there a good sample of bone and skin?
There is no, I don't think there is any good example of knowing how it works under the hood. You know, in samples, typically when they do skinning, they use ID3X mesh and basically all that stuff, and you know, have those libraries take care of everything under the hood. And here, you know, because I'm teaching you advanced graphics, I think you should at least know how this works. Okay, at least, because it can be very tricky to get it right. And I have not seen anything in the literature that actually explains it like this. I have never seen it in literature in such a way that I actually understand the whys and hows of all of this. Unfortunately.
Maybe we can elaborate on this.
Maybe.
Or a web page.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, at least I have it in a slide deck. Okay. And in audio. Explanation. Something. So if bone A is being also transformed, okay, this VC is still the same one, okay, it doesn't change, right? So the left side and the right side of this, okay, they're not identical. Okay. The matrices that go here and here are not identical. If bone A is being moved by some matrix M, like it was before, it only goes on this side, right? Because this is all about getting the vertices as they're defined from one space to another. So the actual animation does not apply. Any more questions before we go on?
I'm having a little trouble understanding the difference between A, the matrix that tells you the position and orientation of the root bone, and the matrix W tells you position and orientation of the entire object.
A, okay, A and C and, excuse me, and B, okay, are part of the definition of this skinned model. There are something that has been authored and is constant, never, ever changes through the execution of a game for any particular model, right?
So what does A tell you if it's a group? Why isn't A just the identity matrix?
It's not the identity matrix because we want to specify this animation as a simple rotation around this axis. We could specify this animation as a series of matrices that contain translations, you know, and everything on them. Okay. But, and that's possible, that's doable. Okay, we could do that. We could embed this A in M somehow. We actually don't, excuse me, we wouldn't do that. What we would do is express this whole thing as one frame of animation. So have it, the result of this stored as part of, you know, the array of values that go into our animation for bone C. Okay? We could do that. There are actually two reasons for not wanting to do that. First, the result of this is a full transformation. It has everything, rotation and translation and everything. Okay? It is a matrix, 12 values. You could represent it possibly with just a quaternion for rotation and a translation, which is still 7 values, right? But it's 7 general values. Okay? And it contains multiple things, logically. It contains the movement of bone A and the movement of bone C together. In one single matrix. You still would have to have the movement of bone A without C. So that would be this, right? Without this.
I think is the root, with its root being the origin, then A, yes, we know, that would be the identity matrix.
It seems like, yeah, the root cone never moves.
Yeah, I did say before that most likely A, particularly A, if A is the root bone, okay, would not ever be there. You know, it would just be the identity matrix. Just A, not B or C or any of the others. Oh, okay, okay. Sorry. Thank you. I didn't understand that question.
Although I think with tiny, it might be a slight translation just so that it's not in the middle of the floor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That would be
a... Yeah. Yeah, that's somewhat typical. That would be akin to moving the model by moving the pedestal, right? Of one of those figurines. But, you know, we're entering kind of implementation detail, you know, which changes from game to game. And yes, I mean, you know, having that A in there, you know, it ends up being redundant. Okay. It's not redundant when you want to specify animation for this bone A, and you do want a different frame of reference for the model itself, for some reason. That's all. Yes?
How is usually the influence of a bone over a vertex of the shaded mesh obtained, calculated?
Or obtained or calculated? Yeah. Oftentimes it's painted by an artist.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Artists decide. I mean, there's all sorts of ways. There's proximity to the bone. You know, you can actually calculate more or less, you know, whether this vertex should be attached to this bone or this one, right? It's, you know, that distinction is pretty obvious. Mm. When it gets to the joints, doing it automatically, especially the shoulder. The shoulder is a horrible joint to do right. Mm. The elbow is great, but the shoulder is horrible to get right. And a lot of the art of making it look better is in actually painting those weights better. You know, having the influences be mapped in an intelligent sort of way. Mm. So any automatic way of doing it is not going to be perfect. Mm. One reason why people choose a Jesus pose like this, including separated legs, you know, is so that there is a clear distinction of where the bones go. Mm. So that when you have varices like here, you know, it knows which of the two bones go with that vertex.
So for artists, does it help if they know anatomy?
Huh?
Does it help if they know anatomy?
Yeah, of course. Always. Artists need to know about anatomy. They need to know about color theory and, you know, color perception. Any sort of perception. Mm. They need to know about... Yes?
Is this how Pixar might animate Woody? Or is that a different
story? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they have a lot of control points.
Yeah, of course. They don't have 10 bones. Maybe they have 1,000. Probably not 1,000, but they'll have 100 or 2. Yes. I've seen games that have more than 100 bones in a character.
This is the same mechanism behind movement capture.
Hmm? Motion capture?
Yeah, motion capture.
Well, motion capture is just about having something moving in the real world and somehow figuring out where the correct animation data is to reproduce that in a virtual setting. That's in general, okay? One of the great things about the Avatar movie is that they did motion capture of facial expressions. You know, that's new. That's cutting edge. Okay? Because the actors would do all the scenes, and all the cameras looking at the actors would actually capture all the nuances of their performance. And then they managed to reproduce all those nuances, or at least some of them, in the virtual setting. And that's one of the things that set it apart from anything else. And they are breaking ground with that. You know, they did. Okay. Yeah. I actually learned all of this about matrices and matrix sandwich. About applying hierarchies, the really, really hard way. You know, I was working at this company and they said, oh, we've acquired this motion capture system. It's a Polhemus system, which works off of magnetic fields. So, you know, you have these set of sensors that you attach to your body somehow, and they have wires, so you end up with a big wad of wires coming down your spine. And they have this big ball that generates a magnetic field, and the sensors can actually sense that field, and so they would return full 6 degrees of freedom for each sensor, which means X, Y, and Z position and ball pitch yaw for orientation, everything. Mm. Of course, you know, I need to figure out, you know, what to do with that data, right? And I didn't know back then. This was in 95. So yeah, I had to kind of figure out the math, and I did it very badly, but ultimately successfully.
Is there any SIGGRAPH article on when this was first done or something like that?
I don't know. I'm not sure. This has been done before. I actually had to bang my head against it until it worked.
Yes. You do list a SIGGRAPH article, I think, for particles or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, those are articles that have come to my attention for some reason. I mean, I haven't actually gone and done any sort of exhaustive search anywhere for those things. Any other questions before we move on?
Do you know anything that might be happening with the UW in this area, in the CS department? Do you have contact with anybody?
Not really. Not really. The course has changed coordinators, and I've never met with her. So,
well, even the research department has been contacted with the undergrad and grad CS department.
Yeah, I don't know.
Research.
I don't know. I'm really, really not involved with any of the UW life. And, you know, with the department or departments that might be related to this, not really, no. Just have a day job and try to keep up with you guys. You know, with grading and feedback and all that. So, we're not done yet. We're not done yet. So, one idea, once you take a look at this, right, you start seeing patterns and seeing how to do things efficiently, you know, all this. Because if you have 100 bones, and for each bone, you have to go and loop through the entire hierarchy and do stuff like that, you know, that can be costly, even if it's just like once per model. Right. So it's actually useful to kind of use the hierarchical nature of this to not have to repeat any computations. Okay. So if we just look at the A bone by itself with nothing else, what we have is this transformation, basically getting a vertex first from model space to A bone space. Then applying the A transformation, and then transforming it back to model local space, and then applying the world matrix for the model, right? So this is, in a way, you know, the world matrix for A, you know, the final skeletal matrix for it. Okay. This is the one we had for C, for any vertices attached to bone C. It's the same thing we had in the previous slide. But you should realize that this, like multiplying A and by this A and this W over here, okay, wait, did I write this? Oh, right. Okay, sorry. I'm forgetting what I'm doing here. So this is just a little mathematical thing that we know to be true, right? We have, this is a world is the same as these AS. I shouldn't have changed the name, but when we have this world matrix for vertices attached to bone A, we can express this. Basically, we can multiply A on the left. You know, remember, everything is non-commutative here. We're talking about matrices. So we multiply this A on the left. It will cancel with these inverse of A. So what we have is this thing over here. Just, you know, the rotation matrix plus transformation from A to local and transformation from local to world space.
A sub W should be A sub S?
Yeah. So we know that to be true, right? From here, we can just multiply on the left this A, and it will cancel with this inverse of A and leave just this. And this is the same thing we see here. So we can substitute it. Now, the interesting part of this is that now we have a perfect sandwich. Inverse of A here, A here. Inverse of C here, C here. And in the middle, the rotation matrix for bone C. Okay. This is something that is always true for matrices, right? When we have, because of the way commutativeness works, if we inverse the product of two matrices, you know, we get the inverses and we also swap them. So this thing here is the same as, you know, this C times A inverse, right? The nice thing is that this separates all concerns, okay? This matrix here, C times A, is transforming from local C space to local model space directly. Instead, you know, it basically subsumes the entire hierarchy here. So what this thing is saying is we transform from local into C, apply a transformation, then transform back from C all the way to local space, and then multiply these AS. And AS is what we, is the matrix that we apply to vertices that are attached to bone A. So what that means is we can do this recursively. We calculate the matrix, the AS, for the parent. And when we use the result of that to calculate the matrix of a child. Okay. So the bone structure is hierarchical. We can actually just traverse that hierarchy. Reusing the values of calculating the parent when we go and calculate the children.
And S in this case is a rotation of D in... Is S in this case a rotation of D in C space?
S would be taking this D bone, child of C, and rotating it by some S, yes. So in this case, it's the same, only we just need to transform from local mold space to D bone space, and then back from D to local bone space. But the thing is, those matrices are the same. Those matrices are part of what defines our skeleton, what defines our model.
Is pre-computing the inverses as well useful, or is inverses cheap?
No, everything is pre-computed. These ones and this ones. Pre-computing the inverses depends on what type of machine you're going to run it on. if computing, you know, if you want more memory, then you compute them at runtime. If you want more faster performance, then you probably pre-compute them and have your model take twice as much for the matrices. It's everything's a choice here. In many ways, calculating them at runtime, you know, it's just the way to go. You know, that has become true of computers no matter what the purpose over the years, right? It used to be that everything is a lookup table, and today that thing is actually bad because going to memory is bad, in general, with any kind of device or computer. You know, memory access has not gotten as fast as CPUs have. So these things, you know, get to a point where if you have too many matrices, you know, you're actually causing too many slowdowns because of memory cache misses and that sort of thing.
That's why we have three levels of caches.
That's why we have three levels of caches, and they help, but they do not eliminate the issue of high latency to memory. So sometimes when calculating something is fast and can be done locally in registers and L1 cache and that sort of thing, then it's better.
Yeah, it's DCH and me and one of those local caches is at first, since you're already using it.
Yeah. I mean, usually those matrices are just like an array. You have all your bones in an array, and you just have them so that parents are always before, come always before children. And then his child just says, oh, and take the matrix from this parent, right? And it stores the DCA and the DCA inverse, or only the DCA. Okay. Questions? So this last part is about the actual blending of effects from multiple bones to one single vertex. Again, you could have a hierarchy and apply it to mesh and have each vertex only be affected by one bone, or you can have it affected by more than one. Right? When that is done, then this blending between the effects of different bones on one vertex, typically it's just a weighted average. With the weights adding up to one, so that what you get really is an average. It is possible to average the matrices, and then multiply by the vertex. It's also possible to just, you know, multiply vertex by matrix multiple times and then average the vertices. If you're transforming positions, it comes out a little as a wash. If you need to transform the positions and the normals and the binormals and the tangents or things like that, then it becomes better to pre-blend the matrices and then apply one, you know, basically find one single world matrix for. Just note that when you do this sort of thing, your matrix ends up being not just rotation and translation. It will also have scales, non-uniform scales and things like that. So when you transform a normal by this matrix, then it will not end up normalized in general. In order to transform it perfectly, you should do it by the inverse of the transpose of the resulting matrix from blending, you know, from the weighted average of the matrices. In practice, nobody does that. Nobody calculates inverse matrices in a shader or anything like that. So you would just transform it by the same matrix and then renormalize the normal, make sure that it's normalized. Yeah. Yes. What I'm saying is, either you eat up the calculation cost of doing it right, or you say, screw this. And
could pass in the inverted matrix to the shader, right? Like you
did. Well, you could pass in the inverted matrices, but that's twice the amount of storage in shader memory space, which is very limited. And just for the matrix and maybe the win, you know, I mean, you do gain more precision, but maybe visually it doesn't matter quite so much. I mean, ultimately what you're doing is moving the vertices and then averaging the results. So, yeah, so your normal ends up pointing not exactly the right way, but I mean, hopefully most vertices get moved by one bone or mostly just one bone. And, you know, the effects of the other bones, you know, are not quite, but close to some sort of rounding error, right? So, and you do get something that's in between, even if it's not the correct in between, you know, when you're averaging normals like that. You do get something. No, it doesn't point the opposite direction, ever. That won't happen. You know, just. Okay.
So is two bones per vertex usually the most?
No. No, I've seen four. Mm. In that Bruce Lee game that I talked about, it was four. Mm. In fact, you will see that there is an FVF, flexible vertex format flag, for specifying bone indices and bone weights. And, you know, those are four components, right? You know, usually you do a byte per weight and a byte per index. Mm. And there are four components in a 32-bit word, right? Four bytes. So four is a nice round number that works very well. Four weights, and, you know, with 256, one over 256 of precision, and 256 different bones possible. Who could ever want more? Somebody always wants more. But, okay. You look like your eyes are going to explode or something. yeah, I mean, this is dense. This is heavy. I do totally agree. But it's actually, you know, this kind of stuff, you know, is one of the things I'm proudest. You know, that I've come up with a good, you know, a reasonably good way of explaining all this. And I'm so proud that I'm actually asking you, as homework, to give me something skinned. Something skinned. I require that you specify somehow which bone each vertex should be moved with. Hmm? Require that you somehow generate the, you know, or modify any geometry. Hmm? You can generate, for all I care, you could generate a teapot and then get the spout to move left and right. Okay? or even just divide the teapot for the middle and have it just two halves of the teapot moving different ways. Okay? But I do want you to modify the vertices so that they have at least something that indicates which bone the vertex should move with. And you have to have at least two bones. I don't require you to implement all these hierarchy. If you don't want to, there's extra grade for that. I just want you to have two root bones that move independently from each other. And I want you to animate them somehow. Animate them, hey, you know, just make a rotation matrix with the angles swerving left and right or something. Okay? It's awesome if it actually plays with your game, You know, if actually it's part of your game, you know, you don't absolutely have to. Okay, you can just stick a T-bottom floating in the middle of it. Be done with it if you want to.
So if we did a car, the roof could be the body, and maybe the two doors and the could be two doors.
Yep.
And none of the vertices, all vertices would be attached to one dome at most in that case.
Yeah. In that case, you would have kind of like three bones-ish, which is, you have the root and two sides, yes.
And that would be it, and it would be attached to one of those three.
Yeah, that would count as three bones, you know, with the barest of hierarchies.
Yeah. Well, if you just did the hood, that would be two bones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, okay. I mean, I've seen people here in class doing things like, you know, this woman that did the rubber ducky game, you know, the ducks, you know, would turn their heads when you turn, you know, when they turn. It's just simple. You know, it's like, turn the head. That was awesome. You know, I've seen somebody put together the, particle effect homework and the skinning homework. So that's that. You know, he had these tentacle coming out from the ground and he was swerving every which way. That was actually several levels of hierarchy through it. You know, that's how you do tentacles. Right? Or even braids or ropes. And so he had this tentacle and he was spewing out blood. And he would actually deposit on the ground and turned red. And cool. Simple but cool. And it was just a cylinder, you know, with several segments and then, you know, just doing multiple bones throughout the length of the cylinder. You know, had somebody try to do, you know, didn't quite succeed, but you know, I've seen somebody try to do a sort of this cone, you know, this kind of like tentacle that ends in a tip, right? And you know, would actually kind of surf down and try to hit the player. So, I don't know. Use your imagination or just, you know, use a D3DX mesh to just generate the cylinder with some divisions in it. And then transform the vertices, like, you know, like I did in the Heart of Render, or, you know, just transform the vertices to suit your purpose, which means having at least a bone index in them, and then use a good shader for it.
Does the .x format support bone indices?
That's a good question. I'm not sure what the .x format supports. I believe that yes, it does, because Tiny is a .x file, and she's perfectly well skinned.
Is there any software to recommend to model something, model a mesh of bones?
No, I do not know about software to do the artist kind of thing. I do know about D3DX, which can generate a teapot or a cylinder or a sphere, and those are good enough for this purpose. I know that you can do, like, there is Blender. You know, Blender is a tool that does everything. You know, it's, I hear from people that it's actually kind of icky to learn. Once you learn it, it does everything, but it's just not the easiest tool to learn. You know, steep curve. So whether you want to use it or not is a little bit your choice. Anybody else? Questions? Things? No? So we don't have a lot of time, but we do have at least a little bit to look at, you know, a game that's actually quite a bit about animation. And this is an old game, right? This is the game that I bought my first Xbox ever for. Game came out and I'm like, okay, I'm ready. In many ways, it's kind of my type of game. Soul Calibur 2. It's a fighting game. Meaning there are only two characters on screen at any one time. So they can like throw the entire GPU, or at least one third of the GPU at each of the characters, and then the last third to the environments.
So this is a 3D Mortal Kombat.
Yeah. Yeah. But I don't know. I mean, personally, this is the best that I've ever played. This is the one that has done the most for me.
In terms of enjoyment?
Yes. Oh, that's right. Well, we'll see what I have. Practice. It's the best to be able to see things. Okay, so let's get... Even her. There.
Does it have a good easy level? I find these kind of games pretty hard for missing.
Yeah, no, this is one of the great things that they did with this game is just about gameplay. Okay, the game, I've seen, a 4-year-old just pick it up and do awesome things with it. Of course, that's not the most recommendable thing maybe because of all the gore and violence, right. But again, nobody ever dies in the game, so that yeah. part is covered, you know, it's like,
oh, so there's no spine
recovery. This kind of comes from the, Soul Edge and such line of games in the PlayStation. They kind of say the soul of the fighters always survives kind of thing. And so yeah, you can do things like this to a little girl and it's okay, you know. No, this is the practice mode. It is great to just take a look at all the animations and all the little things that go in the game, right? So, another thing that is really good is for getting to the command list and saying, signature moves, the malignant cyclone. And you see all the cool moves that way. You don't have to actually know how to do them. And retribution overdrive. Yeah, he can fly. It's kind of crazy. And shoot. He's overpowered. But actually, they also have a very good job with balancing the game. So everybody has strengths and weaknesses. And everybody's weaknesses can be exploited. And also, everybody can defend against their own weaknesses. And so it's very well put together, it's a game like that. So you see, I mean, this is one example of, skeletal animation, right? I mean, you see the legs of the girl, the knees are just one continuous mesh and it moves great, and, same for all the characters. Of course, many of the movements are very fast, and that's actually something that the designers of the game have used, right? So there are movements that do not need a lot of precision. They don't need to be perfect because they're so fast. What you see is just something moved from A to B, but you don't know exactly how. Mm-hmm. Quite often,
it looks like some of her clothing is moving independently of her. Well, maybe not independently, but separately from the bone it's on. Is that just like another part of the skeleton?
Look at her head, okay?
Right.
What is she doing there? I mean, there's an animation that she's doing like this, right?
Yeah.
That's the idle animation. She's just in a stance there, right. But she's not static. But then, some of the animation is kind of layered on top of that. Mm-hmm. And that's the second reason that I didn't quite get to why we don't like pre-compute the world matrices for the bones and be done with it. Mm-hmm. Because that allows us to put controls like in the middle of the skeleton. So we can turn the head left and right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right? And that's just concatenating, or blending the matrices of the animation with the matrix, with the matrix that we want to apply to it. To the girl. So if the girl is going like this, and we move her head like 90 degrees left, then she'll be doing like this, right? Moving the head back and forth again, but in that direction. You know, like a little left from here, a little left from there. That's multiplying the matrices. Okay?
I guess partly what I'm asking is like the way the ribbon on their hair is moving and the bobby socks.
Yeah.
Is that just a deeper level of detail on the skeleton hierarchy?
Okay. The socks here, this is what you mean?
Yeah. So like
I'm not sure what that is about. I know that this thing, for instance, okay, the animation of this is separate from her animation. You know, probably what this is a piece of geometry whose animation, whose matrix, you know, gets calculated by the quickest and dirtiest physics simulation of something waving in the wind, which is, you know, it's not really doing much. So what happens is, once you have all the matrices, you can take any vertex in any of the frames of reference that you have in the mesh. You know, you can take any position that might not even be a vertex, okay? And figure out what it is in world space. You can always do that. Just imagine Superman, right? Shoots lasers from his eyes. So you render those lasers. How? Well, you figure out where the eyes are, and you figure out where they're looking, right? And you do that by taking a point and a normal. And saying, hey, you know, this point and this normal in the mesh, right? They're moving with the head bone. And then, once you've calculated the matrices, you don't just give them to the shader, you also use them and multiply that point and that matrix in the CPU. So you figure out, you know, where those laser beams start.
So the ribbon might be attached to some vertex on your head.
Yeah, again, it doesn't have to be a real vertex. It's just a position in a frame of reference. It
might be a position and normal as well.
Position and normal, yes. It could be more... It could be multiple positions. I mean, you know, it's attached to, several places there,
and
probably.
Also
you know,
the
I mean,
orientation of her head.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the thing is, once you have that, it doesn't matter what animation she's playing, whether you're moving her head or not.
Right.
Nothing matters. You just get the matrices that you give the shader, and use those matrices to actually calculate data about her. In this case, you calculate exactly where that ribbon is coming from so that you can, you know, render a ribbon there.
Yeah, because I was thinking that because they always move with the model, that they might be part of the same skeleton, even though they're not literal bones, as in our bodies, but they kind of hierarchical, like the model implies. Does that make sense at all? Maybe not.
No. I mean, the idea here is that the skeleton and the bones define how this character moves. But then, you know, you can use that to sort of attach things that are not part of the model to the model. Somehow gather intelligence information about that model. Every frame, you know, that responds to all the animations of the model. So that it's suddenly... If I push her and she drops, right, like that, then the ribbon will, you know, will just be going down like crazy. Those points, every frame, you know, will be lower and lower and lower. So the ribbon goes and trails behind somehow, right? I mean, if it follows some sort of reasonable physics formula.
So Tiny doesn't do this, so it looks like she has skin painted on jeans or skin tight jeans.
Yeah, exactly.
Whereas she doesn't.
Yeah. Yeah, she's got most of her, which is just static model, and then she's got props attached to her.
Right.
The hair over here is props, right? Because it moves differently. You know, the sleeves and the vest, you know, are props. This stuff and the pants are props. This stuff is probably props. As opposed to, for instance, this guy who's got absolutely no props that I can see.
I think the chain,
you know, they,
the chains.
Okay, yeah, the chains. And, of course, the weapons. You know, the weapons are in the hands. So what do? You figure out where the hands are, you know, which direction they're looking at, you know, so that you can put this axe in the right place, right? So anyway, just thought, you know, this would be an interesting way of of looking at skeletal animation really at work.
Could you do it real quick in normal mode? In non-practice mode?
Yeah.
It was a real quick game.
Okay. Yes. I should tell you.
What's the current version of this for the Xbox
360? Soul Calibur 4, although I do not like it as much as this one. So. Yes, it is, because I'm playing it in the 360. And I was not about to let this game not be backwards compatible, so I would have worked weekends just for this one. Hey, you know, I had that power, so... And once it works, hey, you know, it works. So they're not going to say no.
Can you work on NechWarrior 2 for me?
Well, that one has support, even though it might be buggy.
Yeah.
No, sorry, Mech Assault 2 works, yeah.
Only if it's in.
Yeah, I mean, it's very hard to, you know, once a game runs and you have to actually play for 4 hours in order to get it to not stop working, considering that, you know, we support 500 games, okay, doing that reliably for all the games is extremely costly. So, I think we ended up playing about 8 hours per game before calling them good. You know, if it plays 8 hours, if it's a network game, play on the network for 8 hours, that sort of thing. Then it was considered good.
Well, in this case, it was.
If we did not see anything. But that doesn't mean that it doesn't have anything. It's just that we didn't see it, or we didn't reach the point, or, I mean, there are limits to everything, right? So, I'm gonna use her because I am the expert. If I can remember, of course.
Well, with Mech Assault 2, is always the same level, not after a certain amount of time, but, you know, I see your point. So that sword whoosh is probably a particle system. Like when the sword is going through a swipe.
Maybe it's motion blur.
Motion blur.
Actually, the sword effects are just, you know, like special effects attached to it. Sorry, I got distracted. So yeah, it's just figuring out where the sword is every frame and just drawing some transparent polygons appropriately. That's all it is.
So the sword would be part of the character skeleton? The sword would be part of the character skeleton.
It could be, or it could be a prop. Yeah.
If it moves somewhat independently, it has to be a prop. But if it's rigid relative to the skeleton, that is
the sword keeps transforming into different things.
Yeah, there's a character that just gets all the weapons and then some. You know, they're kind of made of energy or something.
Maybe.
Not yet. So, if you start examining these animations, you will actually see there. You'll actually see that sometimes they pop. Like, the character is in a pose, and the next frame, it's in a completely different pose. Just because of the requirements of the animation. Okay? I mean, that's something that we haven't quite talked about a lot, but, you know, there's an art to having a full tree of different moves that a character can move, and how to transition from one to the other, and so on. I mean, that starts being kind of, very, very, very tricky to do right. But the thing is, quite often, you don't need to. You know, you can just play one animation. If you need to start another one, just pop it.